supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, one of my favorite topics. It's coming up on time for me to plant garlic in my Pennsylvania garden. But what about down in Florida or out on the West Coast? What do people without a real winter do? Can they grow garlic? We'll walk you through the basics of garlic growing wherever you live after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. It's so nice to speak with you.
It's wonderful to speak with you, Marie. Where are you?
Princeton, New Jersey.
Ah, very good. What can we do for Marie in Princeton?
Well, I have a lilac bush. And my husband and I planted it because as a child, I loved lilacs. We had a bush, and every year it bloomed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we planted this lilac bush about 10 years ago, and this is the truth. I get about one lilac flower a year. It doesn't bloom.
Okay.
And I have to say, I am a very illiterate gardener.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything.
That's all right. None of my plants can read either.
Yeah. Well, do you have any suggestions as to why?
All the books will tell you that you do have to be patient, that a planted lilac probably won't produce a real good number of flowers for 4 or 5 different years. Now, I had an experience similar to you where I was given a new variety of lilac to, quote, test, and I put it in the ground. And after 4 or 5 years, I was getting, like, one flower a year. And, you know, they're not really attractive plants in the wintertime. But then something interesting happened. It got tall enough to get a lot more sun. And so the year after that, suddenly I began to see much better blooms, again, without me doing anything. And every year since then, it has bloomed better simply by the fact that it's gotten higher. Lilacs are very sensitive to sunlight. They will always bloom their best in absolute drop-dead full sun. Now, is yours getting full sun?
Well, it gets full sun in the afternoon.
Yeah, there you go. So what I'm going to suggest is if you have an area that perhaps is more open, that gets morning sun, and that sun persists as late in the day as possible, get another lilac, put it in the ground, you know, be patient with it, but that's the kind of conditions it likes. Otherwise, lilacs really want their base wide open. They don't want any kind of ground cover around them or competition down there. Little bit of compost, as we talked about on the show a couple of weeks ago, a little bit of wood ash because they prefer an alkaline soil. But Princeton's a good climate. Your winters are cold enough for you to get good blooms. I think, you know, the limiting factor with many lilacs is sunlight.
Well, should it be cut back at all?
The only safe time to prune a lilac is, and this is almost cruel, is after the flowers fade. So, for instance, your lilac and my lilac, for better or for worse, all of our flower buds have long been formed for next year. And if you cut it back, it'll probably get less sun.
Okay, well, that's very interesting.
So what I'm going to suggest is this fall is a great time to plant. See if you can get a nice lilac at a good local garden center. You often get great prices on high-quality plants in the fall. And your lilac will already be a year older, technically, so a year closer to blooming. So put it in the ground where it's going to get a lot of sun, especially morning sun, and be out in the open. And then what's the worst that's going to happen is your first one will perk up because it's jealous, And then and then in about 3 years, you'll have a real showpiece in the other one.
Hmm. Well, I think I'll give that a try.
All right. Well, good luck, Marie.
Thank you. I do have to tell you one thing. I have a very good friend who now lives in Toronto, and she told me that mulch equals death on a stick.
Yeah.
That's something that you always said, and I should not over mulch.
Oh, yes. Do you have mulch piled up underneath the lilac?
No, we don't.
Okay, good.
No. Okay.
Yes. No mulch should ever be deeper than 2 inches. No mulch should ever touch a plant, especially the trunk of a tree.
Oh.
And if you have any mulch within 30 feet of a light-colored house or car, you do risk the mulch sending up spores that'll stain the surfaces.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate your taking my call.
I appreciate your making it, Marie. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
No, thank you, Bob. How are you, sir?
I'm forlorn.
Oh, and where is Bob forlorn?
In my garden in Havertown, Pennsylvania, not far from you.
Okay, very good. What's up, Bob? Why are you forlorn?
Well, here are the numbers. I have 12 tomato plants, all started from scratch. And I went out this morning and counted 7 or 8 tiny tomatoes on them. So I have an average of less than 1 tomato per plant. And I'm getting the blossoms, but I'm just not getting the pollination and getting the fruit. And I want to know why.
Well, tomatoes are almost pretty much self-pollinating. I mean, if you're growing them indoors in an area without wind, like in these hydroponic things, they do have bumblebee stations or big fans going on. But tomatoes are pollinated more by vibration, kind of like corn, kind of pollinated by the wind. You don't see bees at the flowers generally.
Right. But I do go out every morning having read your book and others, and I tap the plants, I shake them. Mm-hmm. I use that blossom set spray. All kinds of things like that. And I had a very good year last year, but this year it's, as I say, I'm forlorn.
And the tomatoes are in essentially the same area. They're getting good sun?
I get a couple of hours of sun in the morning, and then from about 2 p.m. on in the afternoon, I get fairly direct sunlight. So I'm not getting the 8 hours of direct sunlight a day.
Right.
But in the past, especially last year, I had tremendous production.
What changed?
And I rotated them from last year.
Okay, but you rotated them simply like a couple of feet away, not to a different part
right.
of your yard.
I've got a 10 by 20 garden, and they're taking up about half of that. So I just moved from one side to the other each year.
Okay, yeah. Is there good space in between them?
Yes, 3 feet.
And oh, that's excellent. And how are they supported?
I have metal stakes and then the wires. Hey, I've read all your stuff. I've got the wire.
Okay, sure. Yeah, okay. Raised beds?
Yes.
And did you amend the beds this year?
Well, what I do is when I do the hole for the plant, I put in some Epsom salt and a tiny bit of like starter fertilizer, but very little. And then the regular soil goes back in there. And then around the top, I put the compost, careful not to have it touch the
right.
stem of the plant.
Okay.
So I think I'm doing it. Oh, and eggshells. Excuse me. I'll
sure.
the eggshells.
Yeah, you said you read all my stuff, so you got to be an eggshell
right.
boy. You know, when tomatoes can't get enough sun, we give mm-hmm. them everything else we can. I want you to stop putting all this junk in the hole. The only thing that
okay.
should go in the hole is eggshells. You don't want to be putting any fertilizer against the roots of the plant or anything else in the hole other than the eggshells. Any fertilizer, anything like that, you apply to the surface and let it work with the soil microbes to get down to the roots.
But by the way, one thing I should have said, Mike, is that the plants themselves look great. I mean,
yeah.
they're doing very
yeah.
well.
Yeah, see,
they're
you have all the symptoms.
Green. Yeah.
Yeah, you have all the symptoms of someone who's used too much nitrogen, who's over-fertilized the plants, who's used like composted horse manure or poultry manure or some chemical high nitrogen fertilizer. So what
right.
I'm going to suggest you do for next year, I want you to dust some rock phosphate over your entire garden. Rock phosphate comes in a very small bag. It's a very concentrated, natural mined form of phosphorus. And I want you to mix that into all your garden soil at a very low rate. But that's not going to be active till next year. But once it is, it'll stay active in the soil for 3 to 5 years. For now, I want you to get some bone meal. And I want you to put some on the surface of the soil around each plant, cover that with compost, and then let's do a cowboy charge. Let's take some of the bone meal and make a slurry out of it in a big 5-gallon bucket with water and a paint stick. And then water the plants with that in the morning the next time you have to water. Let's try to get some phosphorus into these puppies, which is hard to do. Phosphorus uptake takes a fairly long time. I think the plants have too much nitrogen, and we got to try to fight some phosphorus through for them. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Spring City Library in the Philadelphia suburbs on Friday evening, September 30th, at the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show on October 15th and 16th, and at the Huntington Valley Library on Sunday, October 23rd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Grape Garlic and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, my favorite time of year is fast approaching. Time to put new garlic cloves in the ground all up and down the East Coast. Maybe. What do you do where you don't get a real winter like down in Florida? We'll tell everybody how they can grow great garlic after lots more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Lindsay, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing good, Lindsay. How are you?
I'm brilliant, thanks very much.
And where is Lindsay doing great?
I'm Dublin, Ireland.
Oh, well, how wonderful to talk to you. That's so great.
It's nice to talk to you, too, and get your advice.
What can we do for Lindsay in Dublin?
We have what we call busy lizzies here. I'm not sure what you call them there. But we have planted busy lizzies, and they went into full bloom for us. And after a couple of weeks, then we noticed that they were going limp. And within a couple of days, all that was left were stalks.
Okay.
So we were feeding them plant food. They still had some fresh buds on them waiting to bloom. And they just all died completely. And we don't know what happened to them.
Oh, this is really interesting. Now, I believe Dizzy Lizzies are what we call impatiens in America.
Okay.
Did you say they're planted in containers or in the ground?
They were in containers.
Okay. Now, I used to grow a lot of impatiens in my Pennsylvania garden because we have a lot of shade. They're known as one of the best shade-loving annual flowers. Now, sometimes impatiens in the sun will burn up, but you haven't had an unusually hot and sunny summer or anything, have you?
We had, the last week or two, we had some good weather, but not too hot.
Yeah.
We've had hotter weather than this before.
Yeah, I know that Europe can sometimes have heat waves, but it's uncommon. And especially Ireland, the climate tends to be very moderate. There's two things that could be going on here. Years ago, when I planted impatiens and would wake up one morning to find them totally stripped of flowers, exactly as you described, with nothing but the stalks left behind.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I also had some in a planter, and I moved the planter, and underneath were like 100 nasty, fat, happy slugs.
Oh, okay.
And I know that slugs are the bane of gardeners in England itself. I imagine they must be enormous and just all over the place in Ireland, right? So let's talk about slug control first. Over here, one of the things we do, one thing that's common to both countries, you have to be careful with pest control because there's things that are available in one country are not available in the other. But one thing that's available in great quantities in both of our countries is beer. So if you have a beer around or you can, get a can, and I'm not talking Guinness or Bass or anything good. I'm talking about the cheapest beer. Beer you wouldn't drink, although maybe Ireland doesn't have any cheap beer. Maybe you'll have to.
I think it does.
So get a cheap beer, and the next evening, after the sun goes down, put out a bunch of little dishes, like little margarine tubs or something like that, a couple of inches tall, and put a couple of inches of beer in each one. If the culprit is slugs, your little dishes will be filled with dead, drunken slugs in the morning. They are attracted to the beer, and they get overcome by the alcohol when they crawl in. One of the other things you can do is use copper. Now, I don't know about in Ireland, but in America, thin sheets of copper are used for what's called flashing on the roofs of houses to go around the chimneys and stuff.
Yeah.
So if you just put a lane, like a line of copper around the top and the bottom of your containers, the slugs won't be able to crawl up. When slugs touch copper, they actually get an electrical shock.
So copper, I never heard of that before. That's brilliant.
There's also a product called NEMA slug, N-E-M-A slug, that is not available in the United States, but it's available in Great Britain. Your local garden shop may have this product called NEMA slug, and it's organic.
Okay.
The other possibility, which I would hate to be true, is in the United States we have a blight, much like the blight that affected the potato crop in Ireland in the 1800s, which is why there's so many people with Irish last names over here. Like me, my grandparents were chased out by the blight. But blight is just a generic term, and there are many kinds of blight. And the one that affects impatiens is as devastating as the one that affected the potatoes. The first thing that happens on the first day is the flowers just disappear, and then the second day the stems just shrivel up and disappear.
Okay, well, we were left with all the stems, and we still have the stems.
I think you may have slugs. So I want you to try the beer traps on the next evening.
Okay,
and and if you catch a lot of slugs, then you can either keep getting them drunk at night or you can use the copper. But you could also, if you're up late in the evening, like 4 hours after the sun goes down, do you still call flashlights torches over there?
Yes.
If you go out with a torch and you look around late at night, you'll probably see them feeding.
Okay. Okay. I'll give that a go then. The beer traps, I'll do that then.
Right, Lindsay. I have to say it's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, you're very good for taking the call. That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You have a great season.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Doug, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Hey, Doug. It's a pleasure.
I am just ducky today, Doug. Thank you. The pleasure is mine. Where are you, sir?
At this particular moment, I am in the Poconos, a little town called McAdoo. I do live in South Jersey, and that's where the roses that I'm calling about are located.
Okay. So what's the problem with the roses back in the Garden State?
Well, there's a line of roses along the porch. Been there for many years. It's the house where I was born and raised.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, these roses have started the leaves have holes in them, and they're looking really, really bad.
Are the leaves, the holes in the leaves, kind of veiny? That is, the veins of the leaf are sometimes still visible?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. This has been a bad year. After many very lightweight years, all up and down the mid-Atlantic for Japanese beetles, and counterparts that are similar to Japanese beetles, their cousins, the Oriental beetle, who feed at night. So, and also there's a variation of the Japanese beetle called the rose chafer that looks kind of similar and also feeds on roses. All of these beetles have been very active this season, possibly because last year most of the country did not get a very cold winter, so a lot of the grubs survived. And what you're describing is classic Japanese beetle damage. So, but this is a good time to prevent it and for next year. But it's kind of weird. It's very tough to get a handle on Japanese beetles after they show up and after they start feeding. Because once Japanese beetles have been feeding on your roses for about a week, your roses are covered with pheromones that are drawing Japanese beetles in from like a mile away. So once the feeding frenzy starts, it's very difficult to control. Now, are your roses mulched?
Yeah.
Yeah, wood
is a pretty decent.
No. Wood mulch is the worst thing for roses. I mean, it's not really good anywhere unless it's what they call arborist wood chips, and then you're using it very lightly and not touching any plants with it. But almost anything you can buy in a bag that claims to be chipped up bark or something like that is going to be problematic, but roses are affected the worst because these wood mulches naturally breed fungal spores. It's the job of fungal spores in the environment to break down the wood, and roses are very weakened by it. So get rid of that mulch, and I want you to find a nice supply of compost. Get a nice high-quality compost, and it'll be very black-looking. It'll look very good as a mulch, but it will actually protect your roses from disease and strengthen them internally to help prevent insect attack, make them much less attractive to insects, in fact. So as soon as you can, swap out that mulch for an inch of rich black compost. Now, do you feed your roses?
No, we haven't.
Good.
We're just focusing on these now.
No, that's fine. I just want to make sure you're not feeding them. Chemical fertilizers also attract insects to roses.
Oh, okay. So that's good that we're not feeding
them. It's good that you're not feeding them. Yeah. So
right.
Are there any, like, ugly dead flowers on your roses?
Yeah, the petals all fell off.
No, I understand. Okay, so listen. Do you have a pair of pruners?
Yes.
Go out with a good pair of pruners and just remove the, quote, hip. That fat little bulb where the flower head used to be?
Yes.
So take all the hips off your roses so that no strength of the rose itself goes into developing those seeds, because they don't grow roses from those seeds anyway. And you might get lucky. Most of the Japanese beetle action is over for the season, and you're just deadheading the plants, that is, removing the old flowers, could well induce a late run of blooms.
Huh.
I want you then to leave the rose bushes alone after that, unless they flower, and then you can always remove the dead flower heads. But otherwise, leave the rose canes in place over the winter. Do not prune them in the fall. They're already weakened. That's the other worst thing you can do. And then in the spring, no matter what, I want you to put down a fresh inch of compost, not on top of the wood chips. You can use those wood chips anyplace else, but get them out from underneath your roses. That'll take care of your mulching, your feeding. It'll be disease prevention. And actually, before you put the compost down, then you can prune your roses. If you want to control their height, you can cut them back quite a bit. If you just want to remove some canes to improve the look, you can do that. But in the spring, about 2 weeks after new growth appears, that's the perfect time to prune your roses. Then that'll stimulate a lot of healthy new growth. The compost will protect them. And then just keep an eye out to see if Japanese beetles start showing up next season. And take a look on our website at the A to Z Garden Answers section at You Bet Your Garden, and we tell you what to do early in the season. If you can prevent feeding on your roses for the first couple of weeks after the beetles emerge, they will all be living in other people's yards, and they won't come near your roses.
It works for me.
All right. Well, good luck, Doug.
Well, I appreciate all your help. I'll be talking to you next year and tell you how beautiful our roses are.
I think they will be. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ruth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Ruth. How are you?
I'm good, except for my garden. My garden is not good.
But where is Ruth good?
Wilmington, Delaware.
All right. What's wrong in Ruth's Wilmington garden?
Something is eating the tops off of my tomato plants and some of my bean plants.
Okay.
Like chomp. The blossom is gone. No tomatoes are showing up. Just plain gone.
Okay, so I know Wilmington very well. Are you in kind of a suburban area where you have some room to garden?
Yes, I'm in North Wilmington, and actually my property backs up to the Delmarva right-of-way, which is quite open up space, nice and sunny, and they allow us to have a garden there. My garden is raised beds, and it has some wire fencing around it so that animals don't get in.
Yeah, but guess what? That sounds like classic deer damage to me.
The fence is 3 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see hoof marks.
Well, you never do. I've never seen hoof marks, and some years they've eaten more out of my garden than I have.
Well, back a little bit away from this, there is a creek, so many animals are around that general area because it's a little bit wild back there.
I mean, there could be a lot of things doing this. Clean cuts are made by rabbits. They're made
too
by...
Too high up, Mike. Too high up.
Exactly. Exactly. So what you're describing to me is sounds like it's right at browsing height.
And
a 3-foot fence is not going to keep deer out. Now, luckily, there are some things you can do rather than build the true deer fence, which is actually 8 feet high.
Wow.
So my first solution, and the one I use in my own garden, is what's called a motion-activated sprinkler. What I like about that is you only have to buy it once. It's a device you hook up to your garden hose. It comes with a stake to put it in the ground. You point it at your garden. You turn your hose on full blast, and nothing happens until something breaks the electronic beam. Then it shoots them with a cup or three of cold water, and it is highly effective. The one I use is called, quote, the Scarecrow.
And deer are afraid of water sprinkling on them?
No, deer are startled when they get hit by the water. There's this click, there's this whoosh, and then all of a sudden they get hit by this water and they run away.
Oh, okay.
Deer are easily startled.
Okay.
There's also a company that was hard to find for a while but has come back into play, and this is strictly mail order. You would look them up online. It's called the Wireless Deer Fence.
Hmm.
And what they do is they sell you a set of three little stakes that with scent pellets on the top that actually attract deer. And inside the stakes is a capacitor that builds up a charge. You put four AA batteries into the compartment inside. And so you put the scent pellet in, you put the batteries in, you put these things near the plants that have been eaten. Deer come up, the scent pellet attracts them, they lick the top of the steak, they get a mild electrical shock, and again, they run off. Although in your case, because most of your garden is fenced, I would use the motion-activated sprinkler.
Thank you so much.
Good luck, Ruth.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind most, if not all of you, that it's harvest time, cats and kittens. Pick string beans and squash at their smallest for the best flavor. Pick ripe tomatoes promptly so they don't lose flavor sitting out ripe in the sun. But don't pick green peppers. They're not ripe, and they will give you cooties. Allow them to achieve their final beautiful color of red, yellow, orange, or chocolate brown, and cootie-free you will be. But don't go looking for all the details at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with great garlic and more of your frantically fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. My favorite crop, garlic. I'll walk everybody who gets a real winter through the planting things that need to be done in the next month or so. And I'll have hope for those in warmer climates. Yes, there are some ways you can try to grow your own great garlic. And we'll go into great detail about great garlic growing after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making it, Susan. Where are you?
I'm in Paoli, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Yes.
All right. What's up with Susan in Paoli?
Well, this is the first year that I've grown a vegetable garden.
Oh, good for you.
And I have three beautiful tomato plants. They are tall. They are thick. They have dozens of tomatoes, but all the tomatoes are green.
Oh, so you're growing heirlooms.
Yes.
Yeah. Perfectly natural. Perfectly natural. One of the things I always try to get around to mentioning at planting time or at seed starting time is there is a great diversity in the tomato world. There's all kinds of not only varieties, but types. And you can break it down almost any way you want. But one of the big distinctions is tomatoes that are ready in sometimes as early as July. There's a variety called 4th of July for those who want to get early tomatoes and, of course, the famous early girl. And there's an heirloom that comes in very early that's named after me. It's called Stupis. but these are the tomatoes. These are the tomatoes that if you look on the catalog description or the seed packet, they will have a days to maturity of around 55, 65, maybe 70 days. And that's the days it takes from the time you put your tomatoes in the ground around May 15th in Pennsylvania to when you're going to get the first ripe tomatoes. The big heirlooms, the classic ones, Mortgage Lifter, Brandywine, Abraham Lincoln, German Johnson, Paul Robeson, Cherokee Purple, these fabulous big multi-pound tomatoes with great backstories and complex flavors. These are typically 90 to 100 days to maturity. I did some fresh research on tomato growing at the beginning of the season, and there's all these complex stories about this and that. But a tomato will continue growing to a certain stage, and then it'll stop growing. And at that stage, it will then begin the ripening process, which can take maybe a month. And it doesn't show color right away. What it does is it's ripening up internally. It's concentrating sugars and volatile aromatic oils. But once it does start to show color, what's called the breaker stage, once there starts to be the final color of red or a dusky purple, then it's a very short period of time to when that tomato will be dead ripe. But typically, it's not going to happen until right about now. I think you're at the stage where count back. When did you plant? Did you get a late start? Did you get in May 15th?
I got closer to late, Memorial Day.
Okay. So, but a date. Give me a date, like June 1st.
Like around June 1st.
Okay. So you're figuring all of June, all of July, and all of August.
Oh, wow.
And that's 90 days. But that's okay. You're growing the best tasting tomatoes. And it's your first garden. Your plants are healthy and filled with big green tomatoes?
Mm-hmm.
Ding, ding, yeah, ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding. You know, you get to pick a prize off the top shelf. And really, all it is at this point, being patient. Now, I know you're dying for tomatoes. So when the first tomatoes begin to show color, pick a couple of them that are halfway colored up and bring them inside. Now, at that point, it's probably good to get them out of the sun. Don't let them sit on the vine after they're dead ripe. They'll start to lose flavor.
Okay.
But yours are going to ripen up over the next couple weeks. I guarantee it.
Okay, terrific.
And bring a couple of them inside to make sure evil squirrels don't seize defeat for you. And just sit them out in the open in the kitchen counter out of direct sun. And if you want to force that first tomato, put it in a bag with a banana. That's a paper bag, lightly closed with a couple of tomatoes that are halfway colored up and an overripe banana, and check it every day. That will help them ripen up a little faster. But once it starts, Sue, they're going to be coming in like gangbusters.
Terrific.
But you did great for a first year.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your advice. I'm beginning to wonder why everybody else had red tomatoes and I didn't.
Different varieties, lesser flavored tomatoes.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Suze.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I love your show. I always listen to it whenever I can.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Now, are you on a speakerphone or something like that?
No, I'm in a little closet. I can walk outside. Is that better?
Yeah, come out of the closet, Jeff.
Okay, I'm out of the closet.
You don't have to be there anymore. This is the new world. All right, where are you, man?
Center City, Philadelphia.
Okay. Now, since you're saying Center City, I need to know a neighborhood.
Society Hill.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. Just shy of South Philly.
Yep.
All right. What can we do for Jeff in Society Hill?
I've got a deck on my third floor, and I've got a whole garden out there, and I've got blueberries, and you got an apple tree. But they're all in containers, and the blueberries, the leaves are starting to turn. I've had them for 3 or 4 years. They've produced fruit. They're starting to turn yellow, the leaves a little bit. And I'm not sure if I should put them in bigger pots or if I could feed them something. I want to stay organic.
Okay.
And also, now, I've got a fig tree, and the leaves are turning a little yellowish.
Okay. Well, it's been an intensely hot summer, and up on a deck, your plants are exposed to more technical heat than plants that are in the ground where the roots can get down further to cold soil. It's also much more difficult to keep containers watered. And we've had some real treacherous dry stretches over this historically hot summer. Now, you say you've had an apple tree and blueberries outside in pots for 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
Did you do anything to protect these plants?
Nothing. And they lived all through the winter. I've had them for 4 or 5 years on the deck. And the pots are not even that big. They're probably some of the pots are a 2 gallon pot, I would say.
Okay. Well, technically, your plants should have been dead long ago, but sometimes plants don't read the book. So, your blueberry crop is over?
Yeah, it's over. Well over, yeah.
Okay. This is the worst time to replant. What I'm going to tell you to do is go out and get, milled peat moss, the stuff that's typically sold in those very oversized bricks at a garden center.
Yep.
Now make it in cute little bricks as well that are, just like 1 cubic foot.
Mm-hmm.
Go get one of those. And hopefully there's room to put like an inch of the milled peat moss on top of your soil, because your blueberries are showing classic sign of soil that is not acidic enough.
Huh.
So right now, during this hard time, I want you to make sure your plants are really well watered and just put that inch of peat moss on the blueberries. The other plants, just make sure they're well watered.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we get into the winter, or in the spring, you can repot them into bigger pots. And to fill in the new space, I want you to get a really classy bagged potting soil, or preferably something that's called a soil-free mix. Really light. And you want to mix that 50-50 with a good quality bagged compost. The nice thing about using a high-quality compost is half the mix is your plants will get a gentle feeding. And then you should probably give them a feeding with a good liquid or granular organic fertilizer in the spring when they start growing again. And with the blueberries, however, if you're going to use a fertilizer, you should use something like Hollytone, something that adds a little bit of acid to the mix.
Right.
Blueberries want a more acidic soil than anything we grow in. But your fig tree just wants a neutral soil, and your apple tree just wants a rich soil, but no manure. Manure would inhibit the flowering of the plants. Go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. We have articles specifically about potted plants outdoors over the winter. That'll help you. And also read the articles about figs and blueberries, because their care is different. But basically, with your fig tree, you want to give it a nice, rich soil, but no chemical fertilizer, no manure. Manure will inhibit flowering on all these plants. And you want to prune away any winter damage in the spring. You don't want to prune your apple tree until after flowering.
Okay, great.
And probably saying, the blueberries you can prune early in the spring if there's dead wood.
Okay, great. Wow.
All right, and read those articles.
Terrific advice. Thank you.
All right, Jeff. Good luck, sir.
Take care. See ya.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Growing garlic, north and south. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started talking about one of my favorite topics.
It's my favorite, too. Nicole in Tampa, which is in USDA Zone 9A, writes, I enjoy growing herbs, but my husband, who does the cooking, doesn't use many. He does use a ton of garlic. I know it's normally grown over the winter, and I'd like to try it this year. My concern is our warm climate in Central Florida. Are there specific types that would do better here? Any special tips? Well, she's asking the right person. You grow sensational garlic.
Ah, thanks. It really is my thing. I've gotten really good at caring for the raspberries, wineberries, dewberries, alpine strawberries, and all the other fruits my berry-mad wife loves. And I grow great tomatoes, peppers, salad greens, potatoes, and herbs. But I have a special affinity for my garlic. I love how it grows, how it tastes. The almost continuous cycle of planting, harvesting, and replanting. Right now, I'm like Scrooge McDuck in his money bin as I'm sorting through the heads I pulled in July to pick out the biggest cloves for replanting next month.
Right. You always tell people to use the smallest cloves for cooking and save the biggest ones for replanting. That way, you only get big cloves after a couple of years. And it really works. You give me some of your garlic every year, and the cloves are always big and always delicious. But can Nicole have success in Florida? And does she need to stick with softneck varieties?
Well, that's always been my line, softnecks for the South and the West and hardnecks for the North. Now, the hardnecks, so named because the stalks get stiff after you harvest them, love really cold winters. They tend to have naturally big cloves, and they have a huge diversity of flavors and colors.
Yeah, yours have beautiful purple and red-colored wrappers.
Unfortunately, you're probably not going to get those kinds of colors with softneck varieties, so named because their stalks are soft and flexible after harvest. Sometimes called California garlic, these types are less reliant on winter cold, they're great for braiding, and they store for a much longer period of time without sprouting after you harvest them. But you're not going to get those really vivid wrapper colors. And there's a tendency for the heads to produce lots of cloves, but pretty small ones.
And softnecks do require some chilling.
It seems so. Turns out most of what we know about garlic comes from farmers and small-scale growers like me trading information. Now, some of my sources say that warm climate growers need 60 days of temperatures in the low 50s to get good heads. Others say that anything close to that, like just 50 or 60 days of cool nights, is good enough.
So what's your advice?
I think Nicole should purchase a number of different varieties of planting garlic that's described as doing well in warm climates and handle the bulbs two different ways. I think she should plant some outside in a raised bed or even in a big container because she's in Central Florida, but much later than we would in the North, way after Thanksgiving.
And when will your garlic get planted?
Really soon, actually. I used to wait for the supposed lucky Columbus Day in early October, but an older Italian gentleman told me years ago that I should plant my garlic when the kids go back to school, and my harvests have been great ever since. But warm climate growers definitely want to wait until most nights are at least a little cool.
What's the other option?
I think she should take some of the garlic she buys and put a few heads of each variety in a paper bag in the fridge for a couple of months and then plant the cloves in, like, maybe February.
Garlic? In the fridge? That's sacrilege.
Yes, it would be if we were going to eat it, but this is planting garlic. We're pre-chilling the heads to make sure they get that 60 days worth of cool temps. This is pretty much what's done with most spring bulbs that are sold in the South and other warm climates. They're pre-chilled to replace the winter they won't get to experience naturally.
And planting garlic in the spring? My head is spinning here.
Yeah, I know. It's nothing I would ever do in the North. But it is recommended for regions with warm winters. And if winter turns out to be too warm for those outside plants of hers to develop properly, she'll have those pre-chilled bulbs to fall back on.
Okay, so are the basic planting instructions the same?
Pretty much. You gently pull apart the heads and use any cloves that are damaged or missing any parts of their wrappers for cooking. Plant the perfect ones in your loosest, lightest, best-draining soil. Raised beds are ideal for garlic. If your soil is heavy, lighten it up before you plant by mixing in some perlite or a very light and loose natural potting or seed-starting soil. Nothing with chemical fertilizers or those ugly water-holding crystals in it. Plant the cloves pointy end up about 4 inches down, 6 inches deep in really cold climates. Now, your cloves may sprout in the fall, maybe not. It doesn't matter. Mulch the bed with an inch of really well-shredded leaves. Run these leaves through the shredder twice, or use a light, loose mulch like pine straws. In areas with really nasty winters, you can make the mulch a couple of inches deeper, but not heavy. Make sure it's a really light mulch, and wait to apply that mulch until the soil freezes hard for the season. Well, that sure was some interesting information about growing great garlic now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over with links to articles that cover all the other aspects of garlic growing, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to garrot my garlic if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location, especially if you are certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location. Ah, but where you will find the answers to all of those garden questions you were going to ask us. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. We welcome Larissa Sapko to our talented team of web wonders. Rich Banowitz is still here, too. But we will soon have to bid adieu to our indomitable intern, Emma Bixler. Boo-hoo. Our editor, Al Banks, is also still here. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, says, "My, people come and go so quickly around here." I'm not going nowhere, no time. Mike McGrath, no how. And I'll see you, Scarecrow, and your little dog, too, next week. Unless somebody has a bucket of water, then it could go bad.
Look what you've done! I'm melting! Melting! Oh, what a world!
Weeds, weeds, weeds! If only our tomatoes grew this well. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss which weeds to whack and which ones to just warn to whiff-whiff. Plus your fabulous phone calls.